Hello, hello, and welcome to a special edition, a bonus edition one. I didn't actually have a theme for this show planned. Like, special edition is usually because there's a it's for an event or something, something notable is happening. Yeah, I just need to put my voice front and center. You need to hear old Popey Boy's take on this matter. But really, I advertised a podcast for this Sunday just because I just want to try and find ways to distract myself from finishing the book I'm supposed to be finishing, but which is nearly finished. Well, the actual writing of it is nearly finished, but then we're going to have to do deep, deep edits over the next couple of weeks. It's gonna be mucky, gonna be salty, gonna be arduous, gonna be laborious, gonna be fun as well. Hopefully, start to see, you know, take shape, rather than being the discursive ramblings of a man trying to not to submit to his addictive tendency. But then yesterday, like, I knew I was going to touch upon the tragic death of the of Sarah Everard. But then everything went tits up last night. Minister resists calls for Met Chief to resign over policing of event. So a Home Office minister has resisted immediate calls for the head of the Metropolitan Police to resign over the handling of a vigil for Sarah Everard, urging people to wait for explanations from Scotland Yard for officers' behaviour. Remember, so they're saying it's because of lockdown regulations. But when the blokes, the fucking louts, really. I was trying to be diplomatic about it, but the louts who marched on Parliament Square, didn't even march on Parliament Square, just more mosh pitted on Parliament Square to protect the statues. Remember that? Wasn't that during the lockdown as well? And I don't remember police enforcement being that vociferous then, but then I wasn't there last night. But I know, but people who were and have spoken on Twitter are you know they're adamant that it was peaceful until it wasn't, and the explosive agent, the tincture of what's explosive. What is an explosive liquid? What is an explosive liquid? Glycerol. The tincture of glycerol that made everything go berserk was the presence, the punitive presence of the Metropolitan Police. What the fuck were they thinking? What the fuck were they thinking? Even if you're just worried about like the optics, the playing the PR game. What the fuck were they thinking? Oh God. And people are saying you don't understand what a precarious dance police by consent is. Apparently they justified it because of the overriding need to protect people's safety. As Leo Kerr says, I felt safer when I was in charge of my own safety. The safety assistance we get from the government doesn't look that safe, to be honest. And then another very funny tweet. I find Leo quite refreshing in some regards, because rather than you've got people who probably some who do it with the best of intentions talk about men's mental health at the moment, and you know how the inability for men to process their emotions contributes to the destructive effects of the patriarchy, and then they try and do it like, hey guys, like sit down tweet of them throwing off the shrouds of formality and getting into the nitty-gritty and going, you guys, hey, they've been quite sincere now. They're sincere and earnest, fellas, right? Hey, enough silliness, enough nonsense. Cutting through the bullshit now. Cutting through the bullshit. I'm going to say something that might surprise you, right? Something that a lot of people are saying. And that is mental health is fucking crap. Yeah? Bad mental health is not crap. Is crap. My opinion is bipolar, more like no-nola. No-nola for the bipolar. I don't want bipolar. It sounds horrid. Sounds like an imposition. But anyway, yeah, so you've got people who are doing that. And Leo comes in and says, the police clearly decide their level of brutality in crushing a protest based on how likely they are to get booted back. It's funny. It's funny. Come on. It's, he's a comedian. But then you get other people who are disgustingly, like, I mean, Leo is being very much who he is, which is a very funny person. But then you get other disgusting opportunistic people like this guy that I saw everyone sharing yesterday. Now, this guy called Chris Hemmings, author and activist on healthy masculinities. Now, he, when I saw everyone posting this video, for me, it seemed brazenly, transparently opportunistic. And I'm all for riding the momentum of like a pertinent news item, maybe to, you know, slough a little bit of cream off the top for yourself. People might say, oh, Pubba Lonergan's doing it with discourse around social care. I've been banging on about elderly care and social care for nearly a decade now, or actually probably for a decade, when no one gave a shit about them. It was right at the bottom of the news agenda is what was going on in care homes. And I actually, you know, my I I have the receipts of my commitment to that cause that precedes by many years. That precedes my my work doing like my work in doing the care home tour and writing the book and stuff. I'm all for that, but then firstly, I think as long as you express up front that there's a dualism here. There's a bifurcation. It's not a totally selfless thing I'm doing here. I'm doing a bit of it for exposure, but at the same time, the reason I want exposure in that area is because it is a cause that is close to my heart. Now, but this Chris Hemmings was fucking, what was he capitalizing on? He was capitalizing on the fucking death, the murder of Sarah. That's like selfishness in extremis, which literally, I think in extremis means close to death. It just seemed totally disgusting and morally bankrupt to me. And there's also other people who are kind of jumping in, and male voices again, like putting their voice front and center. I know I'm doing that a bit here, but this is my podcast. Like you choose to come and listen to this at your own discretion. And yeah, I'm guessing you sort of tune in because you want to hear what I have to say about a couple of things. And then this morning, I've woken up. And quite a few women, one in particular, said, I briefly dated this Chris Hemmings last summer and experienced multiple incidents of emotional, mental and sexual abuse. And there was, I won't repeat them now because I noticed that she maybe, because of legal advice, she has deleted. She went into specifics and about what he'd done. And like Michael sent me a thing this morning saying, what a surprise, the guy posting for clout turns out to be a cunt. Exactly that. And there's, like I said, there's another person I know who's allegedly spat in the face of a woman who rejected him and is, I've got to be careful with how I word it, and is talking about stuff that is adjacent to conversations about consent and these sorts of things, these types of things. Allegedly, I mean, I really am being vague with that one because I remember this woman posted up a thing saying that they noticed this person was putting on something. And like a show, and that there was a hypocrisy there because he had allegedly done that to her. That's as much as I can say. But I don't think it's betraying confidences because it was put on a public platform. It's put on Twitter. I don't actually know the person. I don't know. But what was I gonna say? Yeah. So there's been that stuff, and then there's been the. So I wrote a few things here about defund the police. Give people a little prosthesis. That's like an old arm hanging off, little twig arms. In the olden days, they used to use as if someone didn't have an arm, They used to use a Savoy. They use the old Savoy arm. I mean, it was a different time. They didn't have the technology. They didn't have the 3D printing. They couldn't. Bionics didn't exist, so they had to make do. And what Savoy seemed to do the trick.
Precy,
that's it. So Precy of how'd you grasp with a Savoy? You'd have to boing everything off the table whenever you're trying to reach for stuff. You have to flap your sav and boing it off the table. Use your other hand to retrieve it. It'd cause more trouble than anything. It wouldn't solve anything. It'd actually end up causing even more trouble than if you just had a normal hardy salt of the earth stump. Now, yeah, so I wrote so this bit I actually wrote in 10th of June 2020, 10:16 apparently. The brotherhood and instinctual defensiveness is bad for law enforcement, and it helps to justify the protesters' ire. Using police brutality and overreach to respond to protests against police brutality leads to a perpetual cycle of force and protest. Shift the power over to the non-violent protesters, police by consent, and the consent is from the people you serve. And then a bit of a kind of overview of defund the police, because people can get there are arguments for abolish the police force, which I don't think is a workable model of community organizing to abolish a police force. But I haven't looked into that deeply. Maybe I'll go through in a moment and see what the arguments that I made about that. Meryl O'Rourke actually sent me a brilliant comedian who did the Being Jewish panel that I put together the other day. She writes for Frankie Boyle and is a stand-up in her own right. Hilarious. Just brilliant lady. She sent me a thing. That's like a Twitter thread of the economics of the abolish the police, I think, or defund the police, maybe. I'm more a theory-based person, thinker, economics, anything to do with numbers. You know, I try and get a grasp on it. Mathematics, I would love to, you know, I've been reading about topology. I'd love to be able to understand mathematics, you know, the very fundamentals of our reality. And it's passing me by. It's passing me by. I want to understand it all, and I just can't. I've got an F in my maths GCSE. And because my mate, my close his friend Louis, was sitting in the desk next to me in the hall, you know, the columns of desks. And he was sitting next to me, and he got my attention. I looked over, he went, look down. I looked down, and he'd pulled the nobble of his foreskin. He's got an extra bit, like a little nobble on the end where it's too long, pulled a little bit of that through his zipper, just for my viewing pleasure. No one else could see. It was just to make me laugh, and I was just constantly distracted by that prat. So we've seen a defunding of public education. Yes, what someone else said, like they're defunding stuff all the time. They're defunding public education. They're defunding the NHS. They're defunding. Like, why is there such uproar? Because we're a conservative country. We're a conservative country. That's why. And they realise that. Uh, I think it's also, I was just reading another thing. So conservatism. Sorry. So conservatives began by being resentful of the new forms of politics that liberals had created. Many were aristocrats who were used to giving orders. They were suspicious of public argument and slow to see the need for an intelligentsia and media of their own. This is why so creative industries, I think, lean left, because encoded within the DNA of those types of industry and practice is a more liberal, progressive mindset. Because conservatism started off as being very aristocratic. Obviously, it changes. I mean, this is why it's versatile to an extent and resilient, because it is able to, I mean, it allows itself to be open to renewal and reinvention by foregrounding. So Tories, however, oh wait, I'll get through this bit first. Some, especially in 19th century France and Germany, entered politics hoping to guarantee their own authority by restoring past practices or by experimenting with authoritarianism. Again, why there's a real strain of authoritarianism on the right there. In Britain and the US, this was impossible. Representative assemblies were already well established and in the process of being further democratized. In these countries, conservatives had to enter the marketplace of political ideas, accepting that political argument would be endless and that victory or defeat would never be permanent. In time, they came to realize that this world of elections and debate was not as unattractive as they had assumed. Most propertied interests gravitated towards the conservative side, fearful of plans to tax or reallocate it. Reallocation, that's what defund the police is. Reallocation and taxation. Oh, fucking hell. I don't know what people talk about, like, well, you know, as it's tax, as if that's money they've been stripped of. Like, that's my money. It's been taken from me. It's not. It's that it's set aside to contribute to the public pot, because you live in a public. You live in this country. You share this country with other people, and you have to contribute to the infrastructure and the overall maintenance of this country. So just slow a bit more off it. I don't care. It's money. Money. There's always a bit more money. There's always money about, except when there's not, and you can't pay your phone bill, and which happens to be regularly. They cut it off. They cut it off for a little while, but I'm mainly in anyway, mainly indoors. And if I'm not, connect to the chip shop Wi-Fi. Easy. Or in the bus. Connect to bus Wi-Fi just so I can send a couple of emails. Hover outside someone's outside a bank. Maybe you've got free Wi-Fi. A restaurant, they also have it. Easy. It's a bit patchy, but you can make it work. And most organs of the state, the legal system, the churches, the armed forces, and the police force tended to sympathize with conservative objectives, and much public opinion still identifies with traditional cultural values and a defense of existing privilege. As a result, conservatives have dominated Western politics since the 1950s, certainly in Germany and Britain, but also in France and the US. And this is where the defund the police model comes in. Wait, is someone lingering? Is it just Alan? No, no one's there. Paranoid? Nah, I'm not paranoid. I'm fine. I'm not paranoid. I mean, just because I have to protect my blood at all costs, just because I have to make sure I strap in my organs in case they take them, you're not having my head or the eyes. Not having the eyes or the windows of the soul, and you are not having my soul. But not paranoid, absolutely stable. No, I'm not paranoid. I am a bit. I said to someone recently, I was talking to, I really have to tamp that down. I constantly have bouts of paranoia and insecurity that people don't like me or are secretly trying to sabotage me. And that's between us, because I don't think I've ever admitted to that. It's something that just flares up in my head every now and again. But I'm aware it's irrational and it's a byproduct of deeper problems, a severance, my sense of connection with people, lack of fulfillment. Just stuff like that, isn't it? That's what exacerbates it. It's probably a mixture of that and circumstance. I find living my life offline for a while, living my life off internet, really helps. Otherwise, I get caught up in trying to interpret hidden signals in people's Twitter feeds. Like, is that actually directed on me? Or am I purposely being excluded from stuff? And yes, that's why I've never admitted to it, because I'm worried it will sound narcissistic. Not everything's about you. But, but it is, because you are in you. You are right. You are steeped. You are totally immersed in you by the very fact that you are you. So see the world through a you lens. It's like a Ouroboros, snake that eats his tail, a sort of feedback loop, the circularity, isn't it? Like when I said you can't me too yourself, when I was masturbating in front of a mirror, because I'd given, by the very act of initiating a masturbation, I had given myself the consent was implicit within me masturbating my own knob off. So the moment I've started, the moment I've consented, because I am me. Me debasing me. Anyway, so I think some of it has been part of the industry with half as well, to be honest. Like, you know, I know a lot of it is because I literally didn't have a single friend in college, other than my tutors and the three friends I had outside of college that I've known since I was born. So back to defund the police. Oh, defund. So defund the police. The most marginalized members of society have been pushed to do survivalist things that have later been criminalized. Defund the police. First responders have a role to play in our society, but they needn't play a role in every single fucking part of it. Rather than deploying police to the home of someone who's battling mental illness and having an episode, we should instead be deploying social workers. People should have equitable access to social workers and guidance counselors rather than punitive enforcement. And the government fails to summon the political will to fund it. And then I can't remember who said this. This is a quote from someone. Can't remember who it's from. I think it is one of the squad, one of the American representatives, of which AOC is one member. Well, there's another one who's, I think she's Somalian. Ilhan Omar. That's a, might be, or is it Talib? There's one called Talib something, I think. Right. The phrase defund the police is politically poisonous. Policy mandates in the civil rights era were considered equally disruptive and offensive to some. When you're disrupting the status quo or ushering in a paradigm shift, I'd love to usher in a paradigm shift. I'd love to usher in a shift where it's fine to, it's fine to have a catheter bag and a colostomy bag just because you're lazy. Just the whole process of like, the you know, the ablution ritual after the fact, like you've shat out a pint glass basically, And then you've got to do the wiping and do the cleaning and do the titivating of the bum plait, the sprucing, and the whole process I find to be eternally agonizing. It's very fraught for me as someone with Crohn's disease. So I would love to just a couple of bags. One at the end of the knob. What one of the guys I used to care for ripped out his catheter with all the accompanying blood and gore, because he thought the balloon inside the catheter, he thought he'd sucked up his bollock. Well, he'd sucked up his bollock, up his knob, like an anteater sucking up a ping pong ball. Well, I'm just about to... what was I going to say? Anyway, back to conservatism. So Tories have tended to have the last laugh because as Edmund Fawcett... Oh, that's the book Conservatism that I've read about on here. So the main things of conservatism are social unity, authority, the police, custom, and property. And redefining each of them as necessary over time. So this is how they keep a hold of their relevance. So social unity was originally seen mainly organically as constituted by hierarchy of ranks and estates, but class tensions made this increasingly inappropriate. So cultural ideas of nationhood have become more common instead. The first authorities to be upheld by conservatives were local gentry and clergy, and sometimes the military. And we know we've got a sort of militarized police force in America more than over here, but which isn't to say that we don't have fucking a brutal police regime, but like there's American states where there's policemen literally going around in fucking tanks. You know, got fucking M, what's the word they're called? A127s, M25s. They've got M25s. They've got AR-15s. AR-15. Yeah. Okay, so the first authorities, yeah, we've got that. So, but the objects of defense are now more likely to be the nation state's legal authority, the market's economic authority, and occasionally the people, an invention by particular elites for particular purposes. Whenever you hear someone talk about the people, they are a member of the elite who realize that they need the divs to keep them afloat. They need to have a certain they need the divs to help bolster their support or something that in a covert roundabout way usually works against the div's own interests. And by the way, I'm saying the div as I am very much part of the div's, but that's how that we're seen by the elites who try to manipulate us. Custom could be interpreted as religious belief, social deference, or loyalty to established institutions and normative ethical and culture standards. Loyalty. I believe in loyalty. I'm also religious. But loyalty to whom? So I'm not going to fucking genuflect to our government. We've never had a government that I've liked, really. Sorry. I always do it through my nose. I've got a deviated septum so that this nostril... I sometimes have to force it open the airway to breathe. This is why sometimes I talk too long and my breathing is terrible. I get a bit lightheaded. Not getting in enough oxygen. So people, and this again back to this defund the police thing on my notes from one of the squad. People need to stop getting bogged down in arguments about language. And that applies to the left as well as the right. Codify Black Lives Matter in policies and budgets. Enshrine that in our laws. So rather than claiming symbolic victories with the use of language, needs to be codified. We need to have something more tangible with policy and stuff. So I've got a few books. One is A Critical Theory of Police Power. I have got The End of Policing as well, another book, but I couldn't find it. So let's get into this. Read a little bit of this. Police begets good order. As I said, I've got. It's kind of, it's awkward because like my dad was in the Met. He's been retired for a long time. He's become less conservative as he's retrained to become a teacher. And the kind of what he used to hold a very binary view of humanity and of, you know, good behavior, bad behavior, which has become a lot more nuanced and layered. And he understands that a huge part of the criminal population are kind of mentally unwell, maladapted people, and if there was other types of protections, care, you know, like we re-diverted funding into care professions and the social workers and stuff like that, that could be maybe a way to bring down the crime rates. But I mean, he didn't always, he supported the cause of Black Lives Matter, but didn't always, you know, support the methods. But then he was part of an institution that's fundamentally racist. So I'm not going to make any. He's my dad. I love him very much, and I know he's been involved and put away people who, you know, like a guy who smashed his girlfriend's skull on a radiator on Christmas Day. He's put away people who have committed atrocious and heinous acts, but there's a complicity to the extremely bad and toxic practice within the police force. So yeah, it's kind of what he doesn't talk about it. That's the thing. I'm not privy to a lot of this stuff. I mean, he worked undercover. I don't understand the role he played in that world. I've heard him talk compassionately about some people he'd locked up. He fought the what he saw in the news last night. His exact words were, "What the fuck were they thinking?" In the handling of the vigil, the way they're kind of desecrated and provoked. But I'm quite hardline anti-police in a way, because I think it runs counter to the community standards and morals and stuff I hold dear. I read a good I should have tried to get that. I read a good article that it's like ticked all the boxes for me as I was reading through it and saying like how as an institution, the essence of the police, it's hard to reconcile that with my belief system, but I can't articulate it properly. On the hoofs, I'll try and formulate a more coherent opinion on it. So here's from the critical. Anyone who considers questions of power cannot help but be struck by the ubiquitous nature, emotional force, and political pull of the idea of order. Order, that's what it is. I'm a defiant personality, childishly defiant in a lot of ways. I mean, it can be a sort of a toxic masculinity in that, and the way it manifests itself in its most ridiculous and puerile way is when I get on stage. I mainly sit or kneel because I think standing seems needy, seems desperate, standing for approval, which is ridiculous. And it's, yeah, I mean, it pretty works against me, if anything. This book contains an argument about the role of police power in the fabrication of social order. As such, it consists of a set of mutually reinforcing claims about the historical role of police, the relevance of the police concept to social and political thought, and the ideological nature of the concepts of law, order, and security. The concept of police has had a peculiar history. Where it once occupied a central place in the work of major thinkers on the grounds that policing was so obviously a central part of state power and thus integral to civilized life, for many years the concept has been relegated to the backwater of police studies. Police science, once a central means of understanding and sustaining the exercise of state power, has been reduced to the study of crime and law enforcement and thus absorbed into the discipline of criminology. In one sense, then, the police concept has been handed over to criminology. But as Paul Rock once noted, the empirical and policy-oriented focus of criminology, having made criminologists conciliatory and Catholic, and having reduced their research to a civil trade in one another's ideas, has shifted the discipline away from the theoretical an argumentative mode which once characterized it. So, police begets good order, mastering the masterless, imposing order. From the late 15th century, political discourse in Europe centered very much on the concept of police, originating in French Burgundian police. In the 15th century, the word police spread across continental. I mean, this is just, like, I want to get into, like, I want to find a bit that like, really get my teeth into. So that's like the history of policing, which we need. I mean, they're the tent poles of this stuff, but highlighting the first rule of law over the rule of police was also a common theme in America, as it appropriated certain ideas from Europe and then handed them back to the central principles of good polity. Politically constituted social order. I think that's what it is. It's like the idea of like who gets to determine what social order looks like. And I can't help but feel there's go into that line of work. I mean, even my dad must have it. To have the temperament to think that you can impose order on society, that you can kind of provide the pen for, in order to herd society into easily manageable units of people and behavior. to assume that you're the one who can do that, you're the fucking brass knuckles who can, who, you know, who can do that work, there's got to be something in the mindset, a kind of thrill seeking side to the police. When you get into stuff like thrill seeking, it becomes ludic. It becomes a sense of vicious play. I think that's what I would find so worrying about it. What are people's intentions? What are people's motivations? I never hear... You hear people like James Comey, for instance. I've got his book, actually. You hear him talking about law enforcement in a way that's very valorizing. Is that valorizing? Valorize. Probably. I don't know. But yeah, in a way that's quite a high register. Ideas of honor and nobility. And I mean, especially in this, he can talk in such a, it's such a kind of Boy Scout way of thinking, but very, very, very staid and purist way of talking about his work. Which you don't hear normal, regular policemen talk in such a way. So then, whenever I have heard policemen talk about their intentions, I mean, my dad's, I don't want to fall into the trap of turning my dad into kind of a fluffy, lovable character. When, as we said, like, you know, he was part of an institution that uses things like that to manipulate the public perception of the police force as being like a benign, approachable presence in social life. But he said that he was an accountant. He studied accountancy at university. First person of his generation to go to university when it was still, you know, it was like the top 4th percentile. And he said he did it because he loved the Sweeney. So he didn't have like a higher purpose. That's what you don't hear policemen talk about, like a higher purpose. It's usually like, oh, I just wanted a bit of excitement. You know, wanted a bit of excitement. Quite liked the kind of brotherhood aspect of it. As I said in that previous thing, this is why that idea of brotherhood can be extremely toxic and damaging. I hear about the camaraderie a lot. I wanted to get involved in the camaraderie of it all. And that's when you hear, this is a fucking game to you lot. It's a fucking game. You went up to that vigil last night where people were honouring, a woman that was brutally murdered by one of their own, one of the police's own. And they went there and they felt like, this is going to seem like I'm undermining my point. That feeling of like trying to get out of burp. Like they went there fucking hopped up on gas, very gaffy. And they felt itchy, you know, they felt itchy, they felt tweaky, they needed to get something out of the system, the adrenaline's already coursing through their veins in case things go haywire, and they engineer a situation in which it spirals out of control. So they then have an excuse to act with force and a certain amount of plausible deniability when it comes to who started the provocation. That's why I just think, fuck them. Got another one saying, police a field guide. And this is good. So it gives you, so it's an illustrated handbook to to the methods, mythologies, and history that animate today's police. It's a survival manual for encounters with cops and police logic. Whether it arrives in the shape of officer-friendly, tasers, curfews, non-compliance, or reformist discourses around so-called bad apples. So let's get to that one, because the bad apple thing is you know, kind of at the forefront of what we're talking about, in that that will be used as an excuse for this bloke, who raped, I don't even want to say his name, so fuck his name, who extinguished the fucking life of young Sarah Everard. You know, a brilliant woman from the testimony. I mean, they're not going to say she's shit. No one's going to say, well, you know, she never got around in. Never got around in. Never dipped around high pockets, fucking high pockets. You got to ask yourself, how much life is in a person like that? No, I'm joking. She sounded, you know, sounded like a good person, and he's fucking scumbag. The bad apple. So, among the most common ways to describe a bad cop is to call him or her a bad apple. This is not an innocent phrase. The bad apple metaphor of police violence condemns the individual bad cop and preserves the perceived righteousness of police as a whole. That's what it is. It's the righteousness, isn't it? It's the righteousness. The righteousness is a blockade to scrutiny or personal reflection on who you are, what role you have in society as a police officer, and what institution you've chosen to be a part of. It's like, that's exactly what Dad, like I said, doesn't talk about it. And I don't think he reflects on any of this. I really, really don't. It's all just war stories now. That's what it is. It's all just trading war stories, or trading work anecdotes. It's not... There's no deeper meaning to it all. Like, he, I don't think he has any like kind of workable, coherent theory of justice. It's he's a sportsman. He loved fucking sport. Loved running up mountains. Loved rugby. That was his main one. Being in the game, being in the police force was just an extension of that, maybe. So, yeah. It establishes that the police violence is no more a political problem than a rotten apple. A bad cop is just an unfortunate fact of nature. The immutability, isn't it? Like the immutability of male violence. It is simultaneously predictable in that it is bound to happen, and unusual in that it doesn't describe an entire crop. It condemns police for unjustified police violence, but excuses the police as an institution by locating the problem as limited to the individual. After all, an apple tree grows apples, not rotten apples, and thus the bad apple must be understood as an aberration. And just as the orchardist confronts the problem of rotten apples by separating the bad apple, he's getting quite deep into the apple analogy there. Starting to talk about the horticultural value of an apple, like it's starting to. And then you got an apple. So where is this? You got the apple, right? You got the apple. Call it a, what are they called, the green ones, a nanny apple, a granny apple. You got a granny apple, right? You got a granny apple, and it's got the green. It's got the green skin there, and you know, keep it watered, but not too much. A little bit of sunlight, I mean, these ones poach well. I think they're a cooking apple. I think they're a cooking apple. So you can use them in your pies. You can use them in your poached fruit, your poached fruit pot there. You can use them in your, yeah, they're a very, very versatile apple. And that concludes my seminar about the police. So too must police separate the bad cops from the good cops. Thus, the bad apple theory defines the problem of police violence as a problem of individuals, not police, and therefore gives momentum to police reform proposals that identify administrative solutions designed and carried out by police brass. That for the brass, the police brass. I hate when academics use the colloquialism, the cop, you fucking police grass, brass grass of the street vernacular, and carried out by police brass that focus on police professionalisation, such as higher wages, more training, better equipment, and community policing, among others. So community policing, yeah, but I mean, we want all the things they mentioned there. I'd like to see that happen in care work. The police are pretty always well compensated, I don't know. I mean, dad's good now with his pension, but there's years when they must have gone somewhere. There was years when we weren't like below the poverty line, nowhere near, but we was like years of being uncomfortable financially. I think, I don't know. I don't really go into the finances of stuff with them, the rents. Yeah, mainly because it then shines a light on my deep mismanagement of my own finances. So I'd rather just keep off that subject altogether, really. Don't want anyone to shine a light on my financial situation, because it is perilous. The best of times, perilous at the best of times. Fucking hell, my credit rating is dog shit. So, with community policing, we end on this. The first thing that nearly all proponents of community policing say about community policing is that there's no definition of community policing. Community policing remains many things to many people, or community policing seems always in vogue, yet its essential qualities remain elusive. Or community policing encompasses a variety of philosophical and practical approaches and is still evolving rapidly. Advocates for community policing claim that it offers a suite of best practices and policies that promote collaboration and partnership with communities as a way to enlist the active support of an entire community in the fabrication of social order. That's what I mean about forcing people into a manageable, like pen, or into a manageable pen of conduct, or whatever. It's not collaboration, is it? It's not a collaboration. You're not collaborating on that. You're just politely asking people to do something, knowing that the threat of punishment hovers over the interaction. And the threat of punishment is always there if they don't comply. That's not collaborative. It emerged as a discourse in policing in the 1960s and 70s in response to the civil unrest of the period. Police were among the targets of civil rights protesters and organised labour, which saw police and as an institution that defended Jim Crow racism and enforced capitalist wage relations through aggressive strike breaking. Yeah, another thing. In response, community policing offers a nostalgic image of an imagined past populated by your friendly neighbour, your neighbourhood cop on the beat, This is a nostalgia that seeks to establish the legitimacy of the police powers. It's what I mean again about the manipulation of the public representation. I don't want to turn them into a fluffy Bobby on the beat. And the legitimacy problem for police is about the legitimacy to use violence. Community police is not about making police friendlier, but rather about making police violence more acceptable. Boom, there you have it. Fuck yes. Anyway, I think I've banged on for enough. So there's your bonus episode. We got into some shit, didn't we? Massive love to you all. Love to the kids. Keep your voice down. There's a baby next door. That's another thing that was always used to hear in my mate Louis' house, because there was, in fact, a baby next door. All right. See you later.